Okay. So it's good to be back in Sharon. Give it a share. This is fun. Okay. So what I want to do is, I like talking about Psak, the nature of Psak. I want to focus on one angle of Psak, and if Ray Clapper was here, he would argue with me more than most of you will. But that's okay. Deborah can report back to him, and he can yell at me tomorrow morning. He can yell at me. It's okay if he has time after he writes this tshuva. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to analyze Psak from a very particular angle. I call this year Psak, Politics, and the Art of Persuasion. Now, there's a perception, correct or incorrect, we'll see, that Psak is, or at least should be, a process of argumentation. Right? That you turn to someone who's more knowledgeable, and you ask them a halachic question, and they analyze the question, they give you an answer. Now, sometimes that answer requires virtually no analysis whatsoever. They can open up a Shulchan Aruch, they can find you the halacha perhaps you didn't know, and they can just convey to you what the answer is. Simple, end of story. Sometimes it requires analysis, and admittedly, analysis can go in different ways, and we all understand that Psak can go in multiple ways, and we can talk for hours about to what extent Psak really has one correct answer. Is there one correct halachic answer to a question or not? Are there multiple truths in theory in heaven and only one truth on earth, or vice versa? But we tend to think that Psak, whatever it is fundamentally intellectual, and we would hope, or at least we think we hope, that the posek should be totally straightforward with us about what he or she is doing. Aria, I like that. What the posek is doing, and should simply make an argument. You can use this recording; it's fine. So it's okay. And that's it, right? And I fall. Oh God, I've been driving for like 5 days. You know. Okay. And that's what we tend to think Psak is. And if we were to discover that a posek was trying to, you know, use not just the intellect, but to use emotion to sway us in a certain direction, or was perhaps being even deceptive, or at least somewhat deceptive, we would at least first glance be opposed to that. We would say that's not the job of a posek. But what I want to argue here is that Psak is, at least sometimes, and should be, not just is, but should be, politics. And politics, in the sense that, in its very basic sense, without the ugly meaning of politics, right? Politics should be the art of governing, or in very, very simple terms, the art of getting things done. Right? In theory, good politics, if it works, should get things done. Now, if the goal of politics is to get things done, we understand that a good politician, shouldn't just be someone who conveys arguments, but should be able to convince people that they should actually follow through on those arguments. And if a politician has all the right ideas, but can't persuade anybody about this because they can't tug on their emotions, they can't actually get people to act, so then they may be very smart, they may be a great jurist, they may be a great theoretician, but they're not a good politician. But politics at its very core is the art of getting things done. That's what it is traditionally. If you look in Source 1, which we'll read in a minute, Aristotle, in his discussion of politics, talks about what tools a politician needs, and one of them is the ability to persuade, and that's what we're going to read in a minute, the modes of persuasion, the art of persuasion, the art of rhetoric. But what I want to argue here is that Psak is politics, and that's a good thing, at least sometimes, that the posek should not be trying to be simply making an argument, but it should be using every tool, even sometimes somewhat deceptive tools, and we'll clarify that in a minute, to ensure that the right answer isn't just heard, but is actually kept. Okay, that's my thesis. Okay, so why do I think this is true? So, again, very simply, the reason I think that this is the case, and I'm going to try to prove my point as we go through, is because, if we think about it, right, what should be the role of a rabbi, of a leader, of a posek? It shouldn't just be to convey information. We all sort of understand that the role of a good rabbi, teacher, whatever the case may be, is to inspire. Now, inspire is just a nice way of saying persuade, right? Inspire is a nice way of saying that we're trying to get people to actually do something. Or we're not just trying to educate. Part of the educator's job is to inspire. Now, yes, there are these stories. I don't know whether they're true. I think of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who apparently spoke Shitati in a monotone because he didn't want anyone to be persuaded by his personality. He wanted them to be persuaded by his argument. And therefore, he chose to always speak in a monotone. And if that works, great. But I think that we have to accept and even perhaps celebrate the fact that Poskim aren't doing that. But again, what I want to argue is that they shouldn't be doing that. Okay, so what I want to look at first, before we get into examples, is a piece from Aristotle. So the first source, this is from Aristotle's Politics. This is a discussion of rhetoric. She writes as follows: of the modes of persuasion furnished by the spoken word, there are three kinds. The first kind depends on the personal character of the speaker. The second, on putting the audience into a certain frame of mind. The third, on the proof or apparent proof provided by the words of the speech itself. So Aristotle first says that when someone wants to make an argument, and makes an argument, what affects whether the person he is talking to or she is talking to is convinced, there's three factors that convince that person. The first one, first and foremost, is, what does he say? The source. And this, like it or not, has been proven psychologically, right? I don't know if you've read it. Your father loves this book. Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. He discusses this at length. Human beings, to simplify our life, not consciously, subconsciously, our mind has created heuristics, has created shortcuts that we use so we don't always have to overanalyze things, and we can use our gut, we can use our intuition for much of what we do. One of those heuristics is that we meet a person, the first impression they make tends to be the one that's almost impossible to get rid of, and once we have an impression of the person, everything they say, everything they do, if we have a good impression of that person, we are more likely to view what they do favorably, we're more likely to believe what they say. If we don't like them, we're more likely to see everything they do afterwards unfavorably and not believe anything they say. And we know this from politics, right? If you look at any of the polls after either the RNC or the DNC, you'll see that the people who are more likely to have approved of what happened in the RNC were people who already were convinced by Trump. People who opposed it already opposed Trump. The same goes for Clinton. Like it or not, that is the reality, right? The most important thing that factors into whether or not we believe someone is whether we believe the person in general, whether we like the person. Okay? Now, I think first things first is we have to admit that that's the case. And the question of whether you're going to be convinced by a posek and whether you're going to actually listen to what they say has a lot to do with whether you already trusted them going into the situation. Now, that's dangerous, right? And this, if Ray Clapper were here, he would make sure that I said this at this point, right? This is obviously dangerous because if someone has charisma but doesn't deserve to have people listening to them, or even if at some point in their life they did, right, charisma can get to your head and you can become the type of person that no longer deserves that charisma. So charisma can be very dangerous because someone can convince people they should listen to them and then suddenly, right, you'll discover that person was in fact a bad person. So that's very dangerous. It's true, but we shouldn't deny that it is true, right? Which is exactly why it's so dangerous, right? The same reason it's dangerous is the same reason that there's a lot of potential there. If the right people have charisma and couldn't convince people, so then, right, a very simple case, right? If you take something which is black and white, right? Should you or should you not light a fire on Shabbos, right? Well, just leave it straight from a pasuk, right? Someone can convey the information that exists, that prohibition exists, there is a pasuk. If they convey that information and don't convince anybody, so they convey the information. If they manage to convince somebody that they should not light a fire on Shabbos, I think we would agree that's a good thing. Now, assuming the person doesn't then misuse his persuasive powers, we would say the fact that he's able to use his personality for good is a good thing. That's, I think, why the Gemara is so insistent that the people that we choose as our teachers should have stellar character, as the Gemara says in source 2, if you just skip to 2, where the Gemara insists that Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mai Dechsiv, Kisif Se Kohen Yishmeru Das, Vitari Vakshu Mipiyu, that the mouth of the, or the lips of the Kohen shall guard wisdom, and you shall seek Torah, teachings from his mouth, Ki Malach Hashem Tzvakot Hu, because he is a God, he is an angel of God. And the Gemara derives im domeh harav l'malach Hashem, if your teacher is like an angel, then yivakshu Torah mipiv. So then you should study Torah from him. V'im lav al yivakshu Torah mipiv. And if not, then avoid him. I think the Gemara here is on the one hand warning against the power of dangerous charisma, because you don't want to go to a teacher who in fact is not worthy of that respect. But on the other hand, is emphasizing the importance that the character of the person you're talking to has on his influence or her influence over you. Therefore, if you're going to find someone who can inspire you and can persuade you, it should be someone who's a good person. So, dangerous as it is, it's clearly true that effective poskim, effective leaders, have a personality that convinces people. So that's point one. The second thing he says is that what convinces people to actually follow what you're doing is emotion. Right? If someone says something in a monotone, you're less likely to actually listen than if they can get you into it, if they can inspire you, if they can tug on your heartstrings. The third most important thing when someone's trying to convince you to do something is the actual content of the argument. Now, we may not like that, but Aristotle, thousands of years ago, noted this was the case. And he continues, he says, we believe good men more fully and more readily than others. This is true, generally, whatever the question is, and absolutely true, where exact certainty is impossible and opinions are divided. He says this is always true, even on facts. And for sure on things which aren't facts. Right, for sure on, let's say, psak, where it could go either way. There might be multiple possibilities, right? Facts. A really persuasive person, maybe he or she can get you to believe that 2 plus 2 is 5. Probably not, right? A really persuasive person, maybe they could. But when there are multiple possibilities, and it's not clear, so then, the more persuasive the person, the more likely you are to believe what they say, regardless of whether they have the better argument, because it's not like either side can prove conclusively what's right or what's wrong. And psak, that's for sure true, as the Ramban writes in his Hakdamah. To the Milchamos Hashem, psak is not like math. By definition, it never has 100-0. Legal argumentation is always a question of probabilities. If it's a question of probabilities, so that opens the possibility to be persuaded in either direction, which makes the personality of the posik that much more important. Aristotle continues, this kind of persuasion, like the others, should be achieved by what the speaker says, not by what people think of his character before he begins to speak. Right? It shouldn't be this way. But it is, right? It is not true, as some writers assumed in their treatises on rhetoric, that the personal goodness revealed by the speaker contributes nothing to his power of persuasion. On the contrary, his character may almost be called the most effective means of persuasion he possesses. Secondly, persuasion may come through the hearers when the speech stirs their emotions. Our judgments when we are pleased and friendly are not the same as when we are pained and hostile. It is toward producing these effects, as we maintain, that present-day writers on rhetoric direct the whole of their efforts. This subject shall be treated in detail when we come to speak of the emotions. And thirdly, persuasion is effected through the speech itself, when we have proved a truth or an apparent truth by means of the persuasive argument suitable to the case in question. There are, then, these three means of effecting persuasion. The man who is to be in command of them must, it is clear, be able to, one, reason logically, two, understand human character and goodness in their various forms, and three, to understand the emotions, that is, to name them, describe them, to know their causes and the way in which they are excited. It thus appears that rhetoric is an offshoot of dialectic and also of ethical studies. Ethical studies may fairly be called political, and for this reason, rhetoric masquerades as political science, and the profession of it is political experts, sometimes from want of education, sometimes from ostentation, sometimes owing to the other human failings, etc. He notes that rhetoric, the ability to speak and persuade, is critical to politics. That means that sometimes people are good at persuading end up being considered good politicians, even if they're not actually good at doing anything. But be that as it may, we can't deny that at the end of the day, critical to the science called politics, to this world of persuasion, is the ability to persuade. And if psak is not just conveying information, but is telling someone what you think they should do, then it would follow, I think, that a posek should also be able to use those same tools to not just convey information, but to persuade the person listening to listen to what they're saying. And Aristotle continues, but we won't read it right now. Okay, so that's my thesis. What I want to do from here on in, though, is to prove it. Because I know there's a lot of people, right, several in this room, and I'm sure many others not in this room, right, who would be very hesitant about putting out the thesis that I just said. Namely, that the job of a posek should be, or at least often is, to persuade rather than just argue. Because we like to think that we're intelligent enough that all we need is persuasive argument, not persuasive in the sense like rhetoric and emotions and personality cults, but simply that someone should convey information, and if it's true, we should listen. But I don't think that's how life actually works, right? And I think recognizing that poskim live in the real world and are dealing with real people means that we shouldn't expect our poskim, our leaders, those making halachic decisions, to be robots. Because that's a misunderstanding of what halacha can be, should be, and I think de facto is. Yeah.
Does this persuasion come at the expense of epistemological value of the content?
So that's where we're going to go. Okay. But what do I mean, right? So what do I mean when I say it's important for the posek to be a politician, to be able to persuade? So that can mean multiple things. Now, sometimes it's not going to come at the cost of the argument, right? Now, here I think this is the least controversial. If I could show you a case where a posek made a straightforward argument, was totally honest about what he was saying, but he happened to also use good rhetoric to try to pull on your heartstrings in addition to convincing you, I think most people would not be too opposed to that. Now, you still might ask me, then why bother doing that? Why don't you just write and convey information? So let me give a case which is an extreme, where I think we can all agree that it was necessary for the poskim to pull on the heartstrings and not just make pure rational arguments. But this is going to be a case where the poskim in question aren't lying to you, they're totally straightforward, they're not being deceptive, they're putting all their cards on the table, they're just also using, right, if we go back to Aristotle's three elements of persuasion, they're not only using arguments, they're also using emotion and personality or authority. They're using all three to get their point across, okay? So that, I think, is going to be the least controversial, right? The fact that poskim, when they're not sacrificing anything intellectually, should use emotion if necessary to make sure that the right result is kept. Okay? So, a very good example is in number 3. This is from a kuntres. This is from a pamphlet called Ma'amar Yirat Tehora. This is a Yoni might know this because I've mentioned it. Ariel, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if you were there this year. I've quoted it before. It's a fascinating pamphlet put out by the Haredi World a few years ago on OCD, or specifically OCD as it is expressed itself in religion. Technical term being scrupulosity. Okay? OCD tends to express it, can express itself in religion, then it's called scrupulosity. And there's a good reason why OCD expresses itself in religion, especially in halacha, which is that halacha is a little bit neurotic, right? The example I like giving to this is there's a fascinating book called Sanity and Sanctity, written by two psychiatrists who work in the Haredi community in Me'ev Sha'arim. The point of the book is to convince fellow psychiatrists and psychologists and mental health professionals of the importance of understanding the culture of their patients before they determine whether or not their patients are in fact suffering. So they give the following example. They say, imagine the following two people. One is named Jack. Every day, when he comes back home, he walks in the house, he takes his shoes, and he immediately pours boiling water on top of his shoes. And then he has a very specific ritual. He goes to his sink, and he washes his hands in boiling hot water that pains his hands for exactly 15 minutes with the same antibacterial soap, which is the strongest, as recommended by doctors, every day, and every time he walks out of the house, and then he immediately puts on plastic gloves before he touches any of the doorknobs in his house because he's petrified of germs. And he has this ritual down to the smallest details of how he avoids germs because he's petrified of germs. This person exhibits textbook case OCD. Okay? Person 1. Person 2. Yaakov, wakes up in the morning every day. And as soon as he gets up in the morning, he mumbles a little ancient Hebrew prayer thanking God. And then he takes a cup, which holds at least 4+ ounces, according to different opinions, has no holes in it, is clean, and takes the water, and he washes his right hand, and then his left, and then his right, and then his left, and his right, and then his left, in the exact same order every day. And then he says a blessing before he dries his hand, and then he dries his hands, and then he can use the bathroom. Then he says another blessing. Then he says the exact same 15 blessings that he says every single morning. And we can go on. The second person sounds neurotic to an outsider, except we know that within the culture of Halachic Judaism, the person is doing exactly what's normal. So the authors of this book argue, right, that it's critical to understand the difference between, right, to understand the culture of the patient, to figure out whether what they're doing is normal by this, their own societal standards, so you don't impose your own idea of what obsession looks like. Obsession means an aberration from the community in which the person suffering lives in, not an aberration based on your society. Okay? But because halacha does have the possibility of expressing itself that way, for example, not Yaakov, but a different person, Reuven, who, instead of doing that, or maybe he does that also, when he says the bracha, right, he's so convinced that he needs to say it with kavana, with intent, that if he doesn't say it with intent, he keeps repeating it, and he ends up spending 45 minutes every morning saying the bracha and washing his hands because he never thinks he has enough intent. Now that is an aberration from his own community, because that's against halacha. That would be saying a series of brachot levatalot, of blessings in vain. So that is a neurosis, right? That's an expression of OCD, of scrupulosity, because it's, right, an unhealthy expression of religious rigor, which is actually incorrect, which is actually false, okay? But because halacha is the way it is, OCD is a problem in the from community, as it is everywhere, maybe even a greater problem. So this pamphlet came out called Yirat Torah, which is aimed at the person, probably teenage boy, suffering from OCD, from scrupulosity. Okay? So this is one paragraph. Number three is one paragraph taken from this pamphlet. And he says, they write to this person. It's written by two people, collecting the psakim of the Haredi Gedolim, of the leaders. And they say it as follows. Yedanu me'od harbe mine nervin. If you didn't catch what that was. Nervin, right? We know nerves. We understand nerves. Right? V'amestaif, it's OCD. Okay? We understand your nerves. V'amestaif b'shar nyanim asha'ein min ha'kavod lefartam. And everything that comes because of it. And we don't want to go into details. So let it be as if we explain them. And then you should learn for everything else. And he says, look, we understand the complexity of people who have OCD. And we understand the stubbornness that they develop. And they don't listen to everyone. They're always the ones who are right. They're always right. And they know more than the gedolim, more than the leaders. Or they think they fear God more. And therefore, they don't want to rely on the gedolim. Afra lipumayhu. We should stuff dirt in their mouths, right? How dare you say such a thing? You know better than the gedolim. Aval min ha'nisayon yadua. Right, from research we know. From testing we know. Shekol ilush nistabchu biyoter. These people it's so complicated for them. So complex. Adasher giyu ma'ibad nafesh. To the point where they're basically drowning. Right, they have water coming up to their mouth. And by time they recognize their mistake, it's gotten so bad that it's nearly impossible to get out of it. He said, but you think you shouldn't listen to the gedolim, to the rabbis? They're telling you, don't repeat that bracha 50 times. Right? You said it once, that's enough. You don't need kavana. Don't be so obsessive. You're saying a bracha levatalo, but you're not listening to the rabbis? You're not listening to the gedolim? He's actually commenting on a much more surprising psak. And he quotes here from Rabbi Yashiv. I didn't put it here, but I'll say the psak. Rabbi Yashiv said to these people, if you are suffering from scrupulosity, and it expresses itself in tefillah, and you can't extricate from yourself from it. So what should you do until you're cured? Don't daven. It's usher for you to daven. It's usher for you to daven until you're cured. It's a fascinating pamphlet if you read it. Fascinating document there. Okay. So he said, I know that the person listening is not going to listen to me because they always think they're right. It's the nature of the disorder that they always think they're right. So he says, Ukfarn Sevenu, but how could you not listen? But we know, Vasita Kholasher Yorucha, Vafil Yomalchal Smoshu, Yamin, Valas, Yamin Shu Smo. The Torah says, listen to the rabbis, even if they write his left or left is right. Kholshakin al Yamin Shu Yamin Val Smoshu Smo. For sure, if right is right and left is left, is Mamash Khyuv Gamur Midoraisa, and that's a biblical obligation. 3 exclamation points. Right? Vikatava Chinuch, and then he quotes the source for this, etc. Okay. We'll stop there on this piece. Now, this piece, the argument is straightforward. Right? The argument halachically is straightforward. Is, you're breaking halacha, you should not break halacha. Right? What you're doing is wrong. Right? That's, all their cards are on the table. But, they also use the modes of persuasion that Aristotle talked about, all three of them. Right? They insist, first of all, on pointing to personalities who might affect them, right? Reminding people of the power of the Gedolim, right? Which in the Haredi world is particularly powerful because of the notion of Das Torah. And they use, right, harsh rhetoric, right, or charged language to try to get the people to understand how bad the path they've gone on is to try to make them change. Now, this case, I would say that this is a perfect example of why a posek should be, at its best, a politician. Because if you turn to this person suffering from OCD, he often, or she often, knows that what we're doing is wrong. And it takes a lot to push them to seek treatment and to actually act based on the treatment. And if you just tell them you are suffering, you can be totally honest with them, but the chances of them listening to you are basically nil. But if you have a relationship with them, and you can pull on their heartstrings, and you can actually tug both on their intellect and on their emotions, the chances that you can actually help this person improve are, I don't know how much better, but definitely better than if you try to convince them in a monotone, right? You are suffering, you should do this, and you didn't try to use every mechanism that you had to convince them to do what needed to be done. So I like using this piece, because here, but if I asked you in a vacuum, if you have someone suffering from mental health illness and you can affect them, right, should you use every mean without being dishonest, without using them to help them? The answer would be yes. So sometimes that responsibility devolves on the posek. Because sometimes, as in this case, there are halachic shailos involved, so the posek's involved. And just like you wouldn't expect the person's parent to be purely rational to them and not try to use their parental connection to help their child, right? Both the authority component of it, the personality component of it, and the emotional component of your mother telling you, you're making me cry watching you suffer like this. You wouldn't expect the person's mother to speak in a monotone to try to convince their child to change their ways. Sometimes poskim act in the exact same way. They have to get something done. And here, these poskim are trying to convince the person suffering from OCD to follow these psakim, which are difficult to follow for this person, so they use every tool in the toolbox.
Aren't you taking a case where posek wrote in this article where they're acting like doctors? They're
yeah.
To heal him.
Correct. I'm purposely taking an extreme case. Right? I'm purposely taking an extreme case where the posek is also acting as a doctor. The posek is also acting as the decisor, right? He's issuing.
Where is he acting like a posek?
Well, that was what I told you, what I didn't put here.
We know that he's not allowed to.
Oh, but that's what I'm saying. He's building also under Rabbi Yashiv Psak that the person is exempt from davening, right? Which is not obvious. Right? That's already a halachic decision that has to be made.
Yeah, but for instance, Rabbi Yashiv Psak is one that's not necessarily directed to the OCD person himself, but to all of us, telling us, if we know an OCD, tell the OCD.
No, it's a psalm for the purpose.
He's just giving a general psalm. That's such a
problem. No, actually, right? Because the authors of this. This pamphlet actually went to the Haredi Gadolim to put this together, right? So it actually is directed. I mean, it's not like a generic psak, right? This was part of a concerted effort to develop a shita that would speak to them. So it, in that sense, it is. Yeah, Deborah.
To what extent does this kind of emotional appeal when it's printed in a pamphlet?
Right, so that's always the question, right? Does it work when it's in a right, when it's written? So obviously in the written word, it's not quite as effective, but... there is that qualification, right? Obviously, personal interaction, which is for sure true, right? I think most people, right, if you said this about a shul rabbi who's acting in his pastoral role, understand that a shul rabbi has a pastoral role and a role as a posek, and therefore he's not expected to talk in a monotone. He's expected to be personable, as opposed to the posek writing, right? Which is why I like this example. I don't know how effective it would be, but... if there's even one person in the world to who this was effective, it was worth adding the rhetoric and adding the connection to the Gedolim, adding whatever it took, right? He was totally honest. The authors are totally honest, right? But they don't suffice with, right, a cold monotonal argument, because any hope they have of this written pamphlet helping someone lies in the fact that it can tug on their emotions or can convince the person who was talking to the OCD patient, right, too, of the urgency of the situation, right? Or whatever, right? I mean, whatever role they're acting, and for sure, right, personal interaction is helpful. Okay. So that's one example. But there, I think, all of us can basically agree that this was a good thing, right? The person was totally being honest. So he's acting a politician, quote-unquote, in the sense that he's trying to convince the person to actually follow his psak. Let me just try to get to the next example, right? But he's not doing anything dishonest whatsoever. Okay? So there I think we can agree that as long as the person doesn't misuse his power of personality, he should use it for good as long as he's being totally honest, right? He's not trying to be deceptive. He's being totally straightforward, but he's also using persuasive tools. That would be a good thing, right? This is an extreme win. We can argue about when he should use persuasive tools and when he shouldn't, but the fact that there are some cases where he should not just be honest, but he should also try to persuade, I think is obvious. Okay. Now let's get a little bit where things are less obvious, right? Okay, what if the posek is being deceptive? Straight out deceptive, right? The posek is not telling you the truth. The posek thinks you should do X, but if he says X, you won't listen, so he says Y. Okay? This is a cynical politics, right? The posek's goal is, I'm not going to call it quite Machiavellian, because we'll see, that I don't know if that fits the case I'm about to look at, right? But basically, you have a case where a posek thinks what you should do is X, but if you say X, it won't listen, so he says Y. Right or wrong? And be careful. Right or wrong?
Could that fit under... what is a reason logically? If a person himself isn't reason logically, and you need to reason illogically to reach his reason, are you then reasoning logically? The case where the guy thinks he's a chicken under the shtetl-like table.
The Rav Nachman story, right? The chicken prince, whatever it's called. Turkey prince? Turkey prince? Right, so here I would say as follows, okay? I'm going to prove, there's going to be no argument with what I just say, that very significant poskim thought that what I just said was totally legitimate. Then we need to ask whether, in fact, it's legitimate, and even if it was once legitimate, is it still legitimate? Okay, that's what I want to do. So let me look at this example first, okay? This is all the way to the other extreme, right? Example one was that sometimes poskim try to persuade in addition to arguing. Now, do poskim ever try to persuade without arguing, or actually, are they deceptive? So, number four, from an important posek, Rav Moshe Iserles, the Rama, right? Most important Ashkenazi posek, period, right? Okay, So the Rambam says it straightforwardly that that is in fact what he does. And this is in Hakdamat Taharas Chatas. He says as follows, Now he's writing to rabbis, because Taharas Chatas is a little bit of a complicated work, so he's writing to rabbis who are presumably reading his book. But now he's explaining how he writes to laity. So he says as follows, I don't want you to think that I don't understand what I'm doing. So let me explain. Sometimes in the Ramah, I would say that you're allowed to be lenient when there's a bit, when there's a monetary loss, or if the person asking the question is poor and can't afford to suffer a loss, or it's Friday, and if you tell the person the food is not kosher, you won't have any food for Shabbos. Now, if you were reading those words, what would you think? What would you think? Why is the Ramah saying it's mutter? Because there's a special dispensation called loss, kavod Shabbos, or for poor people. That's what you would think. But he says, nah, I thought it was mutter. I really thought it was totally mutter. It was totally permitted. According to the halacha, but later poskim were stringent. So, all things being equal, I was machmir. Now, normally I would say be machmir and be stringent like the people who said it was usur. But, okay. But if there's an extenuating circumstance, I would say, just go like the normal halacha. And that's what everybody does. Because of Mari Mint, Bichuvosev Simintesvav, Dani Kalimaza Chalvashi, Rai Shavasa Shavenhain. And the Mari Mint said that poor people and rich people on Erev Shabbos is all the same. Says, but normally you tell them it's because you're poor, because it's Friday. So they won't be shocked when sometimes you say it's permitted, and sometimes you say it's forbidden. So Ramah tells you straightforwardly that what does he do in the Ramah? He's deceptive, right? He's deceptive. Wait a second. Let me just say what he's saying, right? He says very simply, he says, and why? I just want to spell out what he's doing, right? The assumption, the unspoken assumption of the Rambam, which I think there's a lot of merit to, is that the average person doesn't understand how something could be mutter, and yet we should show deference to authorities and treat it as if it's forbidden, even though it's not. That's his assumption. Right? His assumption that there's a value to showing deference to these poskim who were stringent, even though he thinks it's wrong. So therefore, he doesn't want to tell the average person, this is totally permitted, but you should show deference to earlier authorities, because he assumes most people won't listen. So what does he do? He tells them, it's usur. But when there are extenuating circumstances, if he just tells them, look, I think it's always permitted, but normally we should show deference to earlier authorities, but in cases where there's extenuating circumstances, it's not worth it, so just go like the basic halacha. If he said that, then what would happen the next time the Shaila came up on a Wednesday? For the average person, would they be machmir or meikil? They would be meikil. They would say, he said it was permitted. He just wants to like respect some rabbis who said it was forbidden, but he doesn't think it's true, and he's my rabbi. So what? My rabbi says it's permitted. Why do I care what some other rabbi said? What I have to be worried that they said it's forbidden? And if the Ramah told them, look, no, I really think you should show deference to those authorities, the average person is going to say, okay. So what does the Ramah do? He tells you straightforwardly he is deceptive, because he's telling you that it was important for him to make sure that the result was reached, even if the argument was not true. Right? He's telling you this argument is not real. Right? It is a facade. Right? It's a code word for I think this is really permitted. And how do I know that he doesn't think that the Balabatim are going to read this? Because he tells you, right? He's talking to the rabbis. So the person looking in my lengthy book, meaning the rabbi, presumably, or the educated Balabas, but the more educated person who's not reading the abridged thing you find in the Ramah, but is reading the extensive code, Taharas Chatas, so you don't think that I'm being self-contradictory? No, that I'm not really, I don't mean what I say. Right? What I really mean, it's permitted. Okay. So,
doesn't this become part of his Kishala? He's saying it should be mutter, but there are those that are machmir.
And he's for sure, this is
that for those who sit those who be machmir, that
for sure, this is totally
in certain circumstances.
For sure, this is totally consistent with the Ramah's methodology. What's important here is that the Rama is not telling that to the average person. He's not telling the average person that this is a function of his methodology. He's hiding that. Right? He's totally hiding that from the person. Now, I would... Yeah, so, Yoni.
Can't you argue here that the Rama is not necessarily being deceptive in the sense he's telling him, like, the wrong thing? Instead, he's just not sharing...
Right, he's not sharing. He's not lying.
...of the halakha.
What?
He's not really sharing some of all the subtleties of the halakha. I mean, when you give a shear, right, I mean, depending on who you're giving a shear.
Right, meaning it's a shorthand, which is... I'm using deceptive. I mean, it's not a lie, it's deceptive. Right? Meaning, he's pretending there's a category called L'chavot Shabbos.
So would you say that every time a teacher teaches middle schoolers, high schoolers, that they're also being slightly deceptive when they present the sugya in a slightly more simplistic form than they believe the sugya is itself?
Yes, and I think that's a good point, which leads me to my next point, which is, okay, are we yes or no to what the Rama does? So here, I come back to what Yoni said. I would say as follows. I would say the Rama's approach here, I wouldn't call ideal. Not like I'm criticizing Rama. I would say as follows. If you had a community that would accept or could understand the more subtle argument, so then would the Rama's quasi-deception, let's call it, be necessary? No. So it's not ideal in the sense like you could imagine a community where this would not be necessary or not effective. Right? Like Yoni's example. We do this with little kids, right? We don't share with them the subtleties, but we hope that one day they will understand the subtleties. So the Rama here, whether we like what he did or not, right, using this shorthand, which is somewhat deceptive, okay? I think that the Rama would tell you that it's not ideal, right? The ideal would be that people would be educated enough that he didn't have to do this. Whether the Rama was right when he did it, I think a good argument you made, yes, the same way as Yoni said, right? When you're dealing with people who won't understand or appreciate the subtleties, so you can, you're not lying, you're being deceptive in the sense you're not actually sharing the full picture in a way that makes it look like what it isn't. I think nowadays, the Rama's type of approach is almost impossible because, in most cases, because most people can Google, right, and we'll figure out that you're being a little bit deceptive, so it's hard to do something like this. And the Rama's time is a little bit easier, and maybe a little bit more necessary at the same time. Though, I don't think there aren't cases nowadays which would be like this. They may not be ideal, but they exist. I'll give you an example. I was talking once with Ari Lam, who said that he was there once when his grandfather, Rabbi Lam, got a shiloh. A woman came over to him, an elderly woman from his shul, and asked him some basic kashrus question, like my cold... I forget what it was, but I think it was like my cold fleishik spoon fell into my dairy sink. Right? Clean, everything was empty, right? So the halacha is, what do you have to do with the spoon?
Rinse it.
You have to put it away, right? Clean it, put it back in that's it. And Rabbi Lam told her some like whole process. You take the spoon and you stick it into the pot or whatever. He came up with something. And after the woman left, Ari turned to his grandfather and he said, you know, Zeta, with all due respect, like, what are you talking about, right? Like, it's cold, it's clean, like, what do you want? And he said, look, I know this woman for 50 years. If I told her it was mutter, you know what she would do? She would throw it out because she wouldn't believe me. Because the rabbi is a shagetz, right? The rabbi is telling me that I don't have to do anything. My dairy spoon fell into my fleishik sink. I have to throw it out. If I give her something to do, she won't throw it out. So I had to come up with something, because I know this woman, and pastorally, if I told her it was mutter, she would lose money, because every time, right, she comes to me twice a week, right, she would throw out everything she does, she wouldn't listen, I know her, right, I may be elaborating, this is on the way to a wedding, you told me this, okay, but it went something like that, okay, so that story, right, again, is it ideal? In the sense that, do I wish that the woman would just accept the halacha? Probably. But is it necessarily wrong to be a little bit deceptive if the outcome cannot be reached without doing that? I think an argument could be made in both directions. Right? I'll put it that way. I don't think the answer is obvious that you should be deceptive, but I don't think the answer is as obvious as we'd like to think at first glance that it's wrong. Right, I tend to think that there's room to do what Rabbi Lam did to make sure the woman doesn't throw out all or find cutlery in China because, you know, she accidentally put in the wrong cupboard. Right? You don't. Right? At some level, right, you have to be able to deal with the reality. Yeah.
Is it
The Rabbi Leibster is interesting, but at least just in the Ramah, is this really any conceptually different than Halacha Bein Morin, though? Isn't it just basically
So Halacha Bein Morin Kain is the classic example. If we went to the Gemara, when I gave the Sharon Shabbos, that was the first thing your father said. And I said to him, yes, Halacha Bein Morin Kain is the Raya from the Gemara, right? That there are cases that the Gemara basically said exactly what I said, right? That Psak is about more than conveying information, is about being, right? It's about ensuring that certain things happen.
Lahachmir,
right? Lahachmir. Right. Yeah, a little Lahachmir there. And yes, if we wanted to fully understand the case, we would have to just go through the Sugya of Halacha Vein Morin Kain. But what I want to do, what I purposely picked sort of more modern examples just to show this is what happens before. But yes, Halacha Vein Morin Kain is a whole category that seems to be predicated on this. Right? Predicated on this assumption, yeah.
So all of these examples, you're assuming you're not just a more educated person than Yeshoel, but you're intellectually and emotionally superior person, such that you should make decisions about his life and inflict your decisions on his,
correct,
about his life on him. So this is an assumption that I don't know if all of us would be so comfortable with.
Okay.
I'm a pastor.
And that's exactly but that and the, because I know you're not comfortable with it, which is why I'm making pointing out that people do it, and there's at least some cases where we might agree. Right, the OCD case, for the OCD case, that's actually the assumption here, right? That you are healthy and the person is not healthy, right? That's why I brought that case. Because that case, we're actually diagnosing the person, right? The person actually has a diagnosis. That's why I brought that case, because you can't argue on that one. I said, the extent of when you should utilize this and make these assumptions, I'm going to leave open. What I want to do is simply carve out the fact that there are some cases where I think it's undeniably good, some cases where we're really questionable, but even those cases, an argument could be made. And now I want to give one, maybe two more examples. Okay, one more example. Okay, we're running short of time, but I'll take my hour because that's when, you know, how much I plan for it. But okay, I'll take one more case, okay? What's the middle between being totally open, but being persuasive, and being somewhat deceptive? Is there a middle ground? There is. What's the middle ground?
Openly deceptive?
Well, not that extreme. I would say not being deceptive, but not putting all your cards on the table. Okay? Being, right, not deceptive at all, just not putting your cards on the table, right? A middle case that we haven't really discussed is what often happens, right? Where I'm totally honest, I just don't tell you everything. Right? This, I think, is a case where we also might have a little bit of tendency, like Yehuda, to be opposed to this.
Not the whole truth, but the truth.
Not the whole truth, but the truth. Exactly. Here, I want to make an argument that I want to use one particularly compelling example, emotionally compelling example, where I think this one, again, not in all circumstances, but under certain circumstances, a critical tool for a posek to have. And I want to give the following very painful example, okay? In number 6. Skip to 6, okay? The Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg, has many, many tshuvot about abortion. If you read the earlier tshuvot about abortion, the earliest ones are basically written in monotones, because they basically are, he was asked his position on abortion, and he outlined his position. Now, his position is a unique position, which basically is that it's probably rabbinic, it's definitely not murder, even if it's biblical, it's not murder at any level, okay? That's the position that Tzitz Eliezer, okay? Argue on it, not argument, not the point. Because he thinks it's either not murder or perhaps rabbinic, he thinks that we can be pretty lenient in abortion when there's a medical need. Much more lenient, let's say, than Moshe Feinstein. And if you look at his earlier tshuvos, you'll find that he spreads it out and he tells you these are all the positions. Now, there's one big name who happens to hold that abortion is murder. Now, who is that big name? What? Thank you. The Pope. Within Judaism, who's the big name? The Rambam. Now, before we look at the Shaila, okay, I want to ask you a question. Your average person, or even not your average person, what would happen if you told them? Now, the Tzitz Eliezer himself says, look, the Rambam thinks that abortion is murder. Most Rishonim argue on him, and some even think it's Derabbanan, and I think it's probably Derabbanan, and I think it's rabbinic. Okay. So the average person, if you said to them, in a vacuum, right, even in a vacuum, there's a dispute about whether abortion is murder, and the majority of authorities think it's not murder, and some even think it's rabbinic, but there's an outlier, and that outlier happens to be the Rambam, happens to be Maimonides. The average person, 10 minutes later, what do they remember? The Rambam thinks it's murder because they don't know all the other people that you just talked about. Right? You could list them. You could list them, right? You're of Haigon, and you could, but the average person who has been educated, and even the average person who has been educated, right? Any brisker knows, right, that the second you say the Rambam, it because, as Rabbi Bednarsh once said, for a brisker, if it's the Rambam against the Gemara, right, it becomes a machlokes and the Rambam has the upper hand. Right? Like, right, we know that the Rambam looms large. Now, in a vacuum, that's very nice. Now, imagine the following scene. I didn't know who this Shiloh was written to until on Sunday night I had dinner with Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, the author of the Encyclopedia of Medical Ethics, and he told me this Shiloh was to him. So the following Shiloh to Dr. Steinberg. So Dr. Steinberg had the following case, and we'll read it. A couple came to him, and they discovered 3 months into pregnancy that their child had Tay-Sachs. And they asked him, could they abort? So he turned to the Tzitzil Yeser, because who I always thought was the postig of Shari Tzedek, but was not. He just happened to daven in Kamarev there and live across the street. So they asked all their shaylas to him because they couldn't, because it took less time than asking the actual postig. I didn't know that, but okay, you learn new things every day. So they asked Rabbi Steinberg, what's the halacha? Can you abort or not? Now, Rabbi Steinberg, sorry, they asked the Tzitzil Yeser. Now, Rabbi Steinberg is now going to convey this answer back to the parents. Okay? So now, he constructs what I think is a beautiful and brilliantly constructed tshuva. Okay, look at number 6. He says, Havsakana rayon, gwa machala nekrei tesaks. Kasher mavchanim en machala, buubar kavor shlosha chadoshim e rayon. 3 months into pregnancy, they want to abort a child with tesaks. So he says, Hashelahi. So Rai Steinberg asked him as follows. O dod havsakana rayon, gwa machala nekrei tesaks. And aborting a child with tesaks. Which is only revealed later on in pregnancy. Right, it's a horrible disease. It's development is basically is retarded development within the in the first year of birth. In the first year, the child becomes physically and mentally retarded more and more. He develops blindness. And he develops paralysis. And without exception, the child dies by 4. Ein kayom tipul tzpesifi. And there is no treatment for it, except for supporting the child until the child passes away, and psychological help for the parents. There's no hope for saving the child. Maybe you can extend the life of the child a few months. But you can't test nowadays until 3 months. So that means, according to Moshe Feinstein, it's also, it's after 40 days. Okay? But he was asking, 3 months, can we abort the child? So his soul is in his question. Right? Meaning he's coming to me, right, pouring his heart out. And he says, should we see in this disease, which is so bad and so absolute, and so certain, is that enough reason to permit aborting after 3 months? Or is 3 months absolute, and there's no reason after 3 months, except for the possibility the mother would die, to abort the child? So now he answers. After really sitting on this and giving the proper gravity to the situation, based on what I developed in my previous tshuva. Now what does he do right there? Is he putting his cards on the table? Yes. He's being dishonest?
And you're willing to read it.
Right. He's not being dishonest, right? He's telling you, I've developed this elsewhere. If you want to look, look. Then he continues. And he says, and this, such a case, which is so extreme, I think it's permitted to permit until 7 months. As long as right after 7 months, it would be dangerous for the mother. Okay. After that, it's more serious. Fine. So after 7 months, we're not talking about. So next paragraph. So it's obvious halachically that Jews are not put to death for killing, for aborting children, for a fetus. Besides, for one position, people think it's at least forbidden. But many people think it's rabbinic. Or it's just prohibited because you're supposed to be involved in procreation. Here you're doing the reverse. But there's no murder at all. And that's why the Maharit permits it, etc. So now, what did he just do?
He left out all names.
Right? Honest, dishonest. Totally honest, but he didn't put all his cards on the table. Right? He says, most poskim say it's mutter. Some even think it's rabbinic. True? Totally true. Did he put all his cards on the table? No. Did he tell you where to find all his cards? Yes. Right? Honest? Absolutely honest. Right? But now he continues. He says, Imke. If that's the case, Hagabat Mechaim Yesh Sorech. If there's a need, Tsar V'Kaev of pain and anguish, of Terek Adom, Mizeshen, and Nidon. Is there anything worse than this case? Ashir Gram La'im B'Avlad La'Yitzor Kazeh. That would cause the mother, if she gives birth to a child, shekulo omer yisurim umachovim umitato batuach meshach misparshanim, where the child will suffer and will die for sure in a few years. And the parents are watching and they're dimming because they can't do anything. Nothing will help. We can't just take the child away from the parents. That won't help. Not to mention the pain of childbirth. Right, etc. Next line. If it is permitted when there's a need to perform an abortion, this is the case. Right, the classic case. It doesn't matter how the pain is expressed, gufiim or nafshiim, physical or spiritual. Emotional pain, psychological pain, anguish is worse than physical pain that the parents are going to deal with. Vinatan ol barzal tavarecha, and you're putting the metal weight on people, on the yoke on people's shoulders. And sometimes the pain causes physical damage. It drives people crazy, leads to heart attacks, etc. Who more than you understand this? That the pain, the embarrassment, the anguish, the physical and emotional pain, in this case, where they're going to give birth to this child who can't live, it's even better than those other cases where people permit. Skip down to the last line. Right, and therefore, after 3 months, you can abort. And then the last paragraph, he does something brilliant. Right, so far we know that he doesn't quote names. Now he's going to quote names. If I ask you, right? When someone answers a shaila, some people, their style is to go from the Gemara through Rishonim and tell you everything. Some people will just tell you, when there's a shaila, what do they tell you? It's machlokas or Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Right? They'll tell you, it's machlokas modern poskim. Is that honest, dishonest, or just style? Style, right? Some people, when you ask them a shaylus, they tell you, okay, this is what the modern poskim say. They don't bother tracing everything through because that's their style, right? It's a choice. You can argue, it's not dishonest. So now he admits that there are people who poskin that it's murder, He says, who are they? Umashar iti shemivim b'shem ha-meshech chochma reish barshad v'yakel. The meshech chochma thinks that it's murder, and therefore you're liable to the death penalty in the hands of God. And the rugged shaver as well writes that. He says it's murder. And then he says, right, there are people who said that. However, right, and then he goes on to say that everyone else disagrees with them. So what did he do? He wrote a very clever tshuva. He has parents, right, who are now going to get this tshuva from Rabbi Steinberg. He thinks the answer is they're allowed to abort the child. What does he not want to happen? He doesn't want ringing in their minds, you're allowed to abort your child, but the Rambam said you murdered your child. Because these parents are suffering. Their kid, if he's born, will have Tay-Sachs. And it's a painful decision. Should I abort my child or not? The last thing on earth you want to do is put them through the agony of thinking that they're murdering their child. But if he puts all his cards on the table, that's what they're going to hear. So what does he do? He writes a tshuva and he says, look, you want the full picture? Go to my other tshuva. There are some who say it's mutter, there are some who say it's asr. I think the majority of poskim say it's permitted. There are some people who think it's murder. We don't poskim like them. Stylistically, what he did, totally honest, all he did was remove names, and when he quoted names, he jumped a generation. Right? He, instead of talking a tkufa, right, a period, instead of talking about Rishonim, he talks about Achronim. But what is the effect of doing that? That the parents, if they ever look back at this tshuva that talks about their case, right, or they listen to the argument that Ray Steinberg brings back, because he actually would have it in writing. Right? He said what would happen is they would ask the Tzitzel in the morning at Shacharis, and he'd bring back this 20-page tshuva from Minchamariv. Right? So he's bringing it back. I don't know how he did that. Fine. But that was what he did. So he could hand it to the parents. Right? They're going to look at it, and nowhere in the tshuva will he be dishonest, but also nowhere will they have to hear those words, the Rambam thinks you're murdering your child. Instead, what they'll hear is, there are people who think it's mutter, there are people who think it's asr, most people think it's mutter, and there are some people that you might not have heard of, right, Meshachach, Matzav, Panach, whatever, who think it's murder, but no one agrees with them. And what he has done is he's put half his cards on the table. He's been honest. He's made an argument. He's even told you where to find all the information. But he's been just careful enough to not tell you something that could cause you pain. Right? He's not going to tell you that the Rambam thinks it's murder because he doesn't think that's relevant halachically because he thinks we don't paskin that way. And yet, if you tell somebody that, that's a hard thing to hear.
Yeah, you also put a lot of...
And, right, right. And in addition... He, right, plays, that's what he does in terms of the halachic argumentation. In terms of what he adds, he also puts a tremendous amount of pastoral, right, pastoral components to this. He's very emotional because he wants to convince the parents and Rabbi Steinberg that he understands what you're going through and that his psak is an expression of him understanding the situation you're in. So here, I think what the Tzitz Eliezer did was he, right, again, he thinks the right answer is they should abort the child. He knows that by him telling them it's okay, by sheer dint of his personality, right? He is the Tzitz Eliezer. He will make it easier on one level. By using the emotional expressions, the convincing them pastorally he understands what they're going through, he's made it easier. And he also understands that if he constructs his argument in a certain way, he'll give just enough information to be honest, but not too much information to have, right, to have backtracked and to lost all of what he gained with the comfort of the Tzitz Eliezer saying, this is the right thing for you to do. Right? So here, just finish my thought here, I think is a middle example, right, where a posek on the argument level puts half his cards on the table, right, and then uses his personality and his pastoral side, his ability of playing the emotion, to ensure that not only do people do it, but they'll be comfortable doing what he thinks is the right thing to do.
That's the persuasion aspect.
Right, that's the persuasion aspect. Right, so here I have three cases where, again, here I was playing, you know, devil's advocate, but not really devil's advocate, right? We, at the beginning, several people, I think Yehuda still, has the intuition that poskim should ideally be people who just convey information. And any sort of deception or any not putting your cards on the table or playing on the power of personality or an emotion is a weakness. All I wanted to do here is point out, right, that I don't think that's true. There are clearly cases, right? If someone asked you a very basic kasher shayla, not Rabbi Lamb's case, right? Who's going to listen to you? There's no reason for you to be deceptive. There's no reason for you to even use rhetoric or emotion or persuasion. Tell them the halacha and that'll be the end of the story. But because psak and poskim function in the real world, that's not how it works. People do need to be persuaded to do the right thing. Sometimes giving people too much information and being too honest is a problem because your commitment to argumentation is forgetting that sometimes what people need is to be persuaded to do the right thing, and they don't want to hear everything. Right? Reb Chaim famously used to ask shailas and tell the posek not to give him the reasons because he wanted an answer. He didn't want the option of explaining his way out. Because people are real and people respond and have emotions, poskim need to recognize. Now again, this is dangerous because if the wrong person uses it in the wrong way, you end up doing the wrong thing. And we also ideally want to educate people to be more independent.
I think the case of the doctor, I mean, do I really need to know all the case studies and all the work that doctors do?
Right, and I was giving it the medical ethics conference.
Right, so I'm not an expert.
So when at the medical ethics conference, right, that was the example I used. I turned to the doctor and said the same thing is true by you. Sometimes the person just wants an answer. He doesn't want everything because if he hears all of it, he wants certitude, and you're dealing with a patient, and sometimes the best thing for the patient is just to say yes or no. Do this or not.
It's just to question the fact that, you know, this person is the expert, they're better in between
ways. But that is an emotional argument, right? That an emotional argument is to say, look, not an emotional argument, that's a persuasive argument, right? That's my point. It's not necessarily emotional, but it is persuasive, right? It's a persuasion based on authority. So, again, just right, to review these cases, what I wanted to show is at least in some cases, right, the case of the OCD, to show that sometimes the right thing is to be totally upfront about your argument, but to not forget that you're dealing with human beings, and therefore you need to also pull on the other tools in your toolbox to persuade people. Sometimes, in more limited cases, it's even right to be a little bit deceptive. And sometimes in the middle, you have the option of not being deceptive, but recognizing not everybody needs all the truth, and sometimes too much is harmful because the posek, again, wants a certain result without causing too much pain to the people who are listening. Deborah, Jacob, yeah.
Is there a certain human dignity in what we might call informed consent? And when you strip someone's free will by not really giving them a choice, then they're not really doing it. You've just become two people instead of one person, but they've disappeared.
Well, so that's the thing, is that our tendency is to think that way, but then again, right, we don't necessarily, meaning it's true, right, that, like, let's say in the medical world, right, to use the informed consent thing. So the doctors give you information, but they don't necessarily give you, right, too much information, right? They don't, sometimes you might say, look, I don't want to be overwhelmed by it, right? The full informed consent would basically be the full.
Do you read the assigned when she went to the hospital to her.
I do,
because
but
there was a lot of information in there that you don't want.
Right, so the, you know, you wonder, right? I mean, I wondered this, right, when Ara was in the hospital, right? Did I really want the doctor to tell me in so many words, in the middle of childbirth, when you're in pain, right? Do you want Ara or me to hear? There's a 1 in 100,000 chance that, you know, you will get an infection in your brain that will... Now, I knew that, right? I had a friend that happened to and was in the hospital and nearly died, right? Obviously, the doctor at some level had to tell me there could be complications, really severe ones, right? Is it better if the doctor would just say, look, sometimes there are complications and you could die, rather than detail every possible way you could die? Right? Is that not informed consent? Right? This is where yesh ladun, right? Where I think part of us says, well, right, let the person make the decision. Part of us says, look, too much information, right? Because truly giving someone all the information would say, I can't give you any information until you go to medical school and understand what to do with all this. But I mean, that's the problem, right? Is that the extreme is because I could tell you there are 100 studies, but if I don't understand the scientific method that was used in each study and how many people that were used in each study and whether it was double blind, etc., etc., and whether it was done to people of my same, right, whether this one was done amongst people with the same ethnic background as me, such that they might have similar, you know, similar tendencies medically, v'chule, right? I can't necessarily know exactly which one's the right one. The doctor is already not sharing everything with me. He's sharing, now we can argue about how much should be shared, but not everything is ever going to be shared. But halacha is the same way, right? The Tzitzit Eliezer in this Jew, for example, shared a lot of information, right? The person asked, what's the halacha? He said, look, if you want to read, it's what a doctor would say, right? If you want to read more, go there. If you want the upshot of it, some people say this is better, some say this is better. You're asking my professional opinion. This is the right answer, right? That's essentially what he did. That's informed consent, right? The fact, and he told you, he even gave you names, right? He said, of the modern authorities, right? The majority of people say it's permitted. Some say it's murder, but that's a minority position. It's true. All that is true. Right, the fact that the Rambam says is actually irrelevant. Right, it's going to cloud people's judgment rather than make it clear. Right, because telling someone, because there are many other things that people don't do that the Rambam said. Right, they just don't know that. Right, they just know of the Rambam because the Rambam was famous. That it shouldn't have that much weight. Right, the fact that the Rambam says is murder, if the Tzitzit Eliezer is right that everyone else disagrees, it shouldn't have that much weight. You're taking away their choice. Right, Right, you could tell the person, look, spend 20 years in yeshiva so that you understand that sometimes, as great as the Rambam is, we don't paskin that way. But until the person is sensitized to that point, it's very hard to explain to someone that the Rambam is really, really great, but we don't really paskin like him, we paskin like these other people you've never heard of. Right, you're taking away their choice by scaring them with the literal information they have. Right, so yes, there's a value to informed consent, but sometimes we have to be realistic that because a little bit of information can be dangerous, right? We have to be careful about how we convey honest and true information, right? The Tzitzit Eliezer, so that's what I'm pointing, I like this Tzitzit Eliezer because it's not at either extreme, right? It's not being, right? We can all pretty much agree in the OCD case that look, he's being totally honest. He's just also using persuasive mechanism to try to help the person. The Ramaz case might make us a little bit uncomfortable. Maybe we like it or maybe we don't. The Tzitzit Eliezer's case, he's not being totally honest, but he's not being dishonest at all. He's just not putting too much information on the table. Right? And I think we have to just recognize, again, we can argue from today and for forever, for when a posig should be more open and with what types of people you should be more open and should we move towards a community where the number of times that we're not open is less. Right? We can argue about all those things. But the fact that until we get to that point, posig can live in the real world and are trying to get things done and therefore it's actually a good thing under certain circumstances for them to recognize the power of persuasion and use it, I think is something that should just be admitted so that when we see poskim doing it, right, we don't get annoyed or we see rabbis, right, being persuasive. We don't automatically assume, oh, charisma bad, which I know that right, Glaber will argue with me tomorrow, right? No, it's a good thing if used right. It's also dangerous, right? But the fact that people, right, or emotional beings means that anybody who's dealing with people always needs to use all everything that he has or she has at their disposal to make sure to make things better in the best way that they can. So that's the argument I want to make. I gave three examples to just sort of to paint the picture of what I think the poles are. Here. I put one more example, which I'll just say quickly outside. I like the example. You can read it inside. There's a famous tshuva in 5 from Ramosha Feinstein, where everyone quotes it as Ramosha's tshuva, where he says that platonic relationships are usur and yaharik val yavor, right? Are a cardinal sin, right? Because he does sort of say that. But I would argue that's not actually fully what he meant. If you actually read the question, what the question is, a teenager turned to him and said, I have a relationship with girls. I know it's disgusting. And if you tell me that it's wrong, I'm not going to listen to you. If you say it's formally usur, I might think about listening to you. Now, if you just stop right there, if I was Ramosha, I would also come up with a way of saying it's usur. Not because I necessarily think that all relationships are problematic, but if someone has the chutzpah to tell the Gadol HaDor, I'm in a disgusting relationship which I know is wrong, but I'm not going to listen unless you tell me it's usher, you know that that relationship should be stopped because there's something awry there, right? Rav Moshe then does something which, again, this is what I think he's doing. He then constructs an argument which, in which he says it could be Hargval Yav, or it could be a cardinal sin, if you took, and then he puts together a few arguments, if you combined a specific interpretation of Rambam with a specific interpretation of the Ran, and you extend it in such and such a way, etc. I don't think that Rav Moshe is actually arguing that it is that case. I think he's trying to, without saying this is not halachic, he's trying to make a halachic argument to show there is halachic points to be made here, to try to convince the person that what he's doing is wrong. The person said he doesn't want an ethical discourse, so he wants halachic discourse, so he has no choice but to use halachic language. What I think he's doing is just showing a possible halachic argument to make a point without being so explicit as to tell the person, yeah, it's not necessarily usur, but it's a bad idea because the person said he wouldn't listen. You can read the tshuva and see whether you think I'm right or not, but I think that's what he's doing, which is, I think, an interesting one, which is to use halachic argumentation to make a moral point, right? Which is, I think, another model. We're not being totally honest. You're using halachic argumentations to point in a certain direction, right? Which, again, is somewhere in between as well. Okay, those are the tshuva that, just to make the point that I think at some level halacha is and should be politics, right? Should be meant to persuade and not just argue. Again, how we express and the manifestations of it are something that we can argue about, but now it's almost 10 o'clock, so I'm going to turn this off. If you want to ask me questions, fine.